Welcome to the Secured Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Matranga, with a special guest here today from Fox 2 Sierra, good friend of ours, Izzy Freed. Izzy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you having me on. Yeah. This is something we've been discussing for a while.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for the opportunity, so thanks for having me out here.
Yeah, no worries. If you guys can't see in the frame, I know in the left and right frames, maybe in the middle frame, we have a special guest here, Scout. You want to tell us about Scout?
Sure. Scout is my support dog, and she actually got trained by our canine handler, Julian Trent McDonald. He's a former Army Ranger, had two of the most decorated war dogs in American history. Yes.
Nope.
In fact, one of the dogs was modeled after the movie with Channing Tatum.
Dog. Oh, yeah, yeah, dog.
Yeah. So Trent's actually in that movie.
No kidding.
Yes, okay. yes.
Good deal. Love to hear more about that
as
we get to talking here in a little while.
Absolutely.
So Scout's 6 years old.
Yes, sir. 6 years old, pure German Shepherd. And I got her when she was 5 months old. And yeah, she goes wherever I go.
Good deal, man. Yeah. Well, listen, so for our audience, Izzy has a long history of public service. Grew up in New York City, and I'll let you talk a little bit more about that. But New York City or New York State in general?
Both, born in the city, and then my parents moved, we'll say, we called it upstate, but it's really like an hour north of the city.
Okay.
So people who really live upstate, we consider that part of the city.
Okay, I gotcha. And then, served in the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, as part of his, obligation, correct?
It was volunteer.
Volunteer,
so
no kidding.
No obligation to do it. Yes. I'm not a citizen.
You're not Jewish?
I'm Jewish.
Okay.
I'm Jewish. I guess you could say as a Jew, maybe it's your calling.
Right.
But I was under no obligation to serve. I volunteered when I was 17 years old.
Man, let's talk about that a little bit, and then we'll get a little bit into, some of the other things that you've done. But, man, let's talk about that. Let's talk about service, right?
Sure.
So at 17 years old, you felt this obligation, I'm assuming, to serve at a greater need, right? Tell us about that and why you felt the need to do that.
I wish it was more glorious
than
it actually was. I will say this, I was a rambunctious teenager.
Okay.
So things at home were a little bit difficult at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up on the stories of my grandfather who fought in World War II. He was a British soldier, not from Great Britain.
Okay.
He was born in Hungary. But his family was annihilated in the Holocaust. He managed to escape, and his thought was, I'm going to fight. I'm not running. And he joined the British Army, not as a partisan, but as a full-fledged soldier, fought in multiple theaters, North Africa, all over Europe. Friday nights were spent at his house, dinners, and he just unloaded his stories into me. And, you know, back then there was no cable television. Your fantasy was lived in books.
Right.
So he was a real life, character for me, because like I grew up on Jason Bourne and James Bond and Sergeant Rock and the comics. So to have somebody who was living, breathing, sitting across the table from me, regaling me with stories of World War II was fascinating.
Yeah.
And he was a mountain of a man for me, somebody that I wanted to emulate. When I had nowhere to go, I ended up making some money in the summer, and I bought a one-way ticket to Israel. Never left the country, had no ties to Israel, didn't know the language, didn't know the first thing about it, to be honest. I mean, I went to private school, was raised Jewish, so I certainly had an awareness of it. But as a 17-year-old American kid, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I spent the summer with my mom's older sister and my first cousin, who had come over. They had relatives in country. I spent the summer literally touring the country from tip to tip.
Okay.
And I fell in love. I was like, wow, this is like freedom. It's religion. You could be Jewish and have a good time. And I was enamored. But the summer ended, and my aunt and my cousin left and went home. And I was behind going, what am I going to do?
By yourself?
By myself.
Okay, so your grandfather lived in the United States.
Correct.
He did not live in Israel.
He did not.
Okay.
No.
So at that point, you have a decision to make. Like, what am I going to do?
Exactly.
Do I go back to the United States, or, the other option is?
Well, there were two options.
Okay, what's
there were two options.
Let's hear this.
So first, I ran out of money.
Okay.
So I worked as a waiter. Back then, there were no plastic or paper plates, so it was china and silverware. I was 120 pounds sopping wet, and I could not lift the tray of a full table's worth of dishes and silverware. So it would slide off the side, a dish would break, that would come out of my salary or tips. Wasn't conducive for me. Worked in a bar for a short period of time, and again, no direction, no sort of plan. And I bounced literally from job to job until I had no more jobs, nowhere to live.
All in Israel.
All in Israel.
Excuse me.
And bless you.
Thank you.
So I had said in the intro that I was living upstate. I was living in Rockland County before I came over to Israel. Rockland Community College, I had attended there before I went to Israel, early admission. So in 12th grade, I sort of dropped out of high school, went early admissions to Rockland Community College. Ironically, they have a campus in Jerusalem, Israel.
Okay.
Who would have thought? So I signed up for classes at Rockland Community College in Jerusalem, Israel, taking the geography of Israel, the history of Israel, poetry of Israel, and weightlifting.
Okay.
I literally have to show up to one class per semester, and then everything is remote thereafter. Get a syllabus, do the work, turn in your papers, that's it. And having no job, no money, I, on accident, passed the recruiter's office in Jerusalem. And I'm like, oh, that seems interesting. And to be fair, it took me 2 weeks of walking back and forth like a stray dog.
Yeah.
I mean, I walked in, I walked out, I walked in, I walked out. I did not have the wherewithal or the courage at the time to actually sign up.
Mm-hmm.
But they saw me and they would come out, and Yuval Melamed, who was my recruiter, would come out, and he was a strapping 20-year-old. I mean, this guy was beefy and big, but he was just like a softy.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a sweet demeanor and a soft voice, and he literally would bring me coffee and talk to me and showed me pictures. And eventually I gave in and I signed up, and it was right before the high holidays. So right after the high holidays, I went to a boot camp.
What year was this?
That was 92.
Okay.
1992. Yeah, so Gulf War, right after Gulf War had kicked off. I remember my friends had gone for their gap year after high school. They went to Israel right before college. I went straight to college. And I remember them calling home and sending pictures, hard pictures back then, of gas masks. And they had to have sealed rooms in the dormitories.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, worried about gas attacks and the like. But I came right after that.
How long was that after your aunt had moved back to the United States or gone back to the United States? You know, you said that they had left and you kind of were left there.
Yeah.
Or you stayed there. How long after that happened did, this interaction with the recruiter occur?
I'd say within 4 to 6 weeks.
4 to 6 weeks?
Yeah, if that long.
Okay, so in that 4 to 6 weeks, you're busing, you're waiting tables, everything.
I went to the places that we had visited on vacation, figuring, okay, if I had a good time on vacation, it's going to be a great time all year. But you got to work.
So you had an American passport?
Yes, sir.
No Jewish passport? No, nothing, because you weren't a Jewish citizen.
I'm sorry, Israeli. Correct.
I apologize. Israeli citizen.
Yes.
So in 1992, you know, things were different then, right?
Correct. Yes.
How was it difficult to get work in Israel and Jerusalem as an American who just happened to be kind of a holdover? Just a layover, you know. How difficult was that? Was there any issues there?
None whatsoever. I didn't go to an employment agency. These were all word of mouth jobs.
Okay.
You know, you're getting paid cash.
Right.
And as a 17-year-old, I didn't even know what's a legal job, what's not a legal job.
Yeah.
It's like help wanted. Right.
Apply within. Yeah.
Stop. That was it. Okay. Right. So to be a busboy, nobody's checking your papers.
What do you think about like today? If you take that same situation from 1992 to today, do you think the same would occur? Do you think that the dynamic has changed significantly due to, you know, the political issues there, war, whatnot?
like would a 17-year-old American kid that ends up there, you know, find the same path?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good question. Probably not. I would say not. You know, if I had to think of my kids, I don't think there's a snowball's chance in hell that they would take the path that I took at all. I think I'd get a call.
Yeah.
You know, dad.
Send money.
Yeah.
Venmo me, cash at me, money. I need help.
Right.
You know.
That's not to say that there aren't patriotic kids today who have an affinity for the land of Israel and
service in general.
Absolutely. So so the flip side to that coin is you look at what's going on. I mean, in the entire existence of Israel, in the 75 years that it's been in existence, it's never had a call up, a reservist call up of the proportions that it had after October 7th. Like you have the Yom Kippur War, Six-Day War, War of Independence, right? Where the country's fighting for its survival.
Right.
All right. This is their equivalent of 9/11. You have people coming from all walks of life, from all corners of the globe.
Mm-hmm.
I was on one of the first planes back after October 7th. I mean, I get chills now thinking about it. You had people, you know, people had just got out of the army. And it's a big deal in Israel. When you finish your mandatory 3 years of service, they go travel the world. It's a lot of PTSD and trauma to work off. So they travel to like Thailand, India, you know, far off places where meditation and spirituality, they just dropped everything and came back. I mean, our plane was jam packed. You had families of people who lost people, you know, in Nachal Oz and Be'eri, people whose family had hostages taken, and then you had soldiers.
Let me ask you a question. Why is it, do you think, that October 7th, is as recent as it is, it's just like we've forgotten already? You know, why is that globally that we not only have we forgotten already, but, you know, you look around the United States and you see at these universities, you know, all of these demonstrations that are being brought on by, you know, quite frankly, what I would consider uninformed young adults that, and listen, I'm not advocating for violence. I'm not saying that there are not innocent people on both sides that have been victims, but it appears that, you know, at these demonstrations, you see, you know, there's this pro-Palestinian movement, right? But they seem to have forgotten about the 1,000 plus individuals that have either perished or we don't even know where they are, that have been kidnapped on October the 7th. Why is that? What do you think that's attributed to?
Well, I don't think it started with October 7th. I feel, and personal opinion, all right, I can only speak for myself.
Right.
For me, if I had to look at and analyze this, I think that this started with COVID and George Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
I think that And that's a whole nother conversation.
Right.
In terms
we can get into it.
In terms of like lockdowns and whatnot. But the world as we know it changed.
Yeah.
All right. In my lifetime, I mean, I watched 9/11 happen, right? We lived through the Gulf War. We lived through the GWAT. I've seen President Reagan get shot on television. The Challenger, the shuttle explode. I mean, we have a lifetime of history that's incredible when you think about it, right?
Yep.
But the world grinding to a halt was not something that I think any of us contemplated.
Well, I don't think that even though we couldn't contemplate it, I don't think that we would quite understand the effects of the world, you know, coming to a halt either. You know, if you look at, you know, within our communities, the increased level of anxiety, depression, mental health disorders, all the things that occurred, the social anxieties that have developed, you know, COVID in itself has caused a tremendous amount of stress. And, you know, one of the things that I said in 2020, I can recall being on some of the COVID calls early on in January of 2020, before it had even come to the United States. And I remember being on the state calls and I was the only individual that was a representation from the education space. And they kind of were like chuckling that, you know, why is this guy on here? You know, because I knew that this had potential to be something, you know, really big. and you were looking at some of the lockdowns that were already occurring in China. And I remember sitting in an administrator's office and looking at, you know, we were watching TV and the things that were happening in China, like in education, with, you know, the basically putting kids in bubble suits and all this other weird stuff. And they were like, oh, that would never happen here. I said, don't say never. It could absolutely happen here, you know. And then here we are 3 short months later, March of 2020, boom, you know, we're starting to see these cases pop up throughout the United States. And, you know, it's changed the dynamic. I think COVID changed the dynamic of how we operate as people. Whether good or bad, I think the majority of that brought out the worst in Americans, or just in people in general. And so, you know, you were saying that, you know, COVID, George Floyd, you know, you saw this beginning to happen even before October the 7th. So is it the desensitizing of, you know, the society as a whole? What do you think it was, or what do you think it's led us to, you know, to where we're at today, you know, in regards to like the George Floyd incident or COVID, that has caused us to just forget about October 7th or forget about the victims there and to focus our attention on, you know, being pro-Palestinian rather than just being pro-humanitarian? What is that, man? What's this all about?
So I for me, looking at it through my lens of my sure. life experience, I would say that there was a paradigm shift as a result of those two instances coming in close succession, right? Coming together. And that paradigm shift is you look at the world pre and post that, and sort of what our focus and our priorities were, right? And I'll say, like, you know, normal was different pre, right. and today's normal, I would posit, is anything but normal,
yeah.
right? Not to quote Stranger Things, but I feel like we're living in the upside down, honestly.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right, where law and order that used to be on top and chaos and mayhem would be unacceptable is now flipped on its right. head. And now chaos and mayhem seems to be the norm. Law and order is like, oh my gosh, like defund the police. Police are bad. They're not. Like,
yeah, I always chuckle at those that want to, you know, take police out of schools or defund the police. I always laugh at that because they're the first ones to call when they need assistance, when they're getting, you know, when they're involved in a domestic dispute and they're being assaulted by their spouse, whether they be male or female, when something's happening to a loved one and they need, you know, some type of law enforcement intervention. I mean, you still want to defund the police? It makes no sense to me. I don't know if this is just, you know, our society has gotten so crazy where, you know, I've said multiple times over the last couple of years, there just really are no boundaries anymore. That, you know, what used to be socially acceptable in regards to boundaries, we've far crossed that threshold. And I don't think we're going back. How do we rein this back in? I don't know if we can, you know. It's concerning in the line of work that we're in,
right?
For me, is how much more chaotic can the world get? And I believe it can get a hell of a lot more chaotic, especially with what we're seeing in Israel with, you know, the October 7th massacre and the kidnapping, you know, the aggression from Russia into the Ukraine, which, you know, where does that stop? China and Russia and Iran seeming to be this axis of evil dating back to George Bush's days, you know. And then just this week, you know, we have the death of the Iranian president.
Yep.
Let's be honest here. I mean, I personally don't think that there's any way that this is an accident. And, you know, it is what it is. You know, a month ago, Iran launched how many missiles into Israel?
Hundreds. Yep.
And how many were effective?
Zero. Practically. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love it, dude.
Yeah.
That is so awesome, man.
I'll tell you something. You know, I have my counterparts that are still over there.
Yeah.
Are they're in the military, and I'm watching the news like everybody else is watching the news, right? Now, to be fair, outside of that attack, my news came from social media.
Sure.
I do not turn on the news on television.
Yeah, well, you never know, you know, which angle it's coming from, right?
But I'm now watching missiles like everybody else is watching missiles, and I get on the horn immediately, and I call my buddies that are over there, and I'm like, are you okay? Are you okay? And he's like, dude, I'm sleeping.
Yeah,
I'm like, what do you mean you're sleeping? I go, there's missiles coming. He's like, no, there aren't. I go, I'm watching it. I'm watching it in front of my eyes. He goes, that's not here. It's very pinpoint.
Isolated.
Isolated, exactly. And he goes, they're all getting intercepted. He goes, I'm going to go back to sleep now.
Yeah.
And I was like blown away.
Yeah. I tell you, man, the art of deception amongst the media, man, it is a real thing.
Yeah.
It is a real thing. You know, and for me, you know, man, we need to do a series. We need to do a multiple part series because there's so much that I want to talk to you about, right? Because I feel like we kind of align in the same ways. But, you know, the art of deception on behalf of the media is scary. And what I mean by that is, you know, I'm extremely observant. It's a blessing and it's a curse. I've always known that even since I was a kid, I had a gift to be observant, you know, watching people's behaviors and patterns, and you know, that's always been a gift of mine, which is, you know, no accident. It was in the field that I was in professionally, but I tell you, man, it's sickening and it's super sad to me to see people that I love and that I care about that get so wrapped up into the things that they heard or the things that they saw, because what I always tell them is what you heard and what you see is not always accurate. That a lot of that is intentional because they're trying to invoke some type of response from you. They're trying to invoke some type of outrage in you that really shouldn't exist, right? You talk about George Floyd, and I have a conversation about this. You know, Mike and I talk about this all the time. That to me, unfortunately, a man lost his life, you know, regardless of how you feel about who he was as a person, whether he was a drug addict, whether he was breaking the law, at the end of the day, a man is dead. I personally believe that perception is reality, and that all that Derek Chauvin would have had to have done was just lift him up, you know, put him in a position of disadvantage. You know this. You guys teach tactics at Fox 2 Sierra. We'll get into that here shortly. Perception is everything. We would have ever heard about that incident if they would have just lifted him up, sat him on his behind, put him in a position of disadvantage. It's the perception of that. And so, you know, here we are. We witnessed this, and it wasn't right. But at the end of the day, what also wasn't right was the reaction to that. You know, burning down cities, causing billions of dollars in taxpayer repaired or damages that taxpayers are going to have to repair. People are so easily manipulated. And it's sad to me to see friends and family get so wrapped up into one way or another without taking that tactical pause, taking a deep breath. Everything that you do, you should just take a tactical pause, take a deep breath. Really examine, where's your source? What's the motivation behind it? What's the outcome, right? Because whether people believe it or not, there truly is a faction within the world that wants to manipulate the narrative to benefit them one way or another. And so, you know, with October 7th, like I said, you know, what's really bothersome to me is that you see these American kids on these universities that, you know, and I don't want to discredit them, because if you look back at the Vietnam War, which my father fought in, you know, there was a lot of, you know, the protests that were going on during Vietnam, those were college kids. And if you look back 40, 50 years ago, looking back, a lot of the things that those college kids were saying back then, they were accurate. I mean, we're fighting, you know, nonsense, useless wars that, you know, 50,000 Americans didn't have to die for, right? And I'm not saying these kids shouldn't have a right to protest. They absolutely have a right to protest. That's their constitutional right. But I question, like, you're defending one evil act for another. It makes no sense to me, you know, why they can't see that this was an unprovoked attack on October 7th, that women were raped and murdered and brutally sexualized. And where's your empathy for that?
As I'm listening to you, I'm starting to have some realizations. And again, my perspective on things. I would venture to say the difference between the Vietnam War and sort of October 7th, if we're going to do a comparison and in terms of like the kids and colleges, is we've moved away from having interpersonal communication and relationships. You and I, we're sitting a few feet apart.
Sure.
I'm able to look at you. We're having a conversation. And maybe we disagree on things. Maybe we agree on things. But what we're not doing is jumping up and down, you know, getting after each other's throats.
Civil discourse.
Yeah. I always say conversation, not confrontation. Engage me in a conversation. I'm happy to have spirited debate and admit when I'm wrong.
Sure.
Right? Because I'm not right all the time.
What happened to that art of that?
It's gone.
Because do you think it died with our generation? I'm assuming you're about my age. I'm 40. I'll be 47.
I'm 51.
Soon. Okay, so we're pretty close in age. You think it died with our generation?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You look at, you know, so you're talking about where's the lack of empathy? Like, where did it go, right? In Vietnam, guys were coming back in wheelchairs, missing limbs, right? And you're able to talk to them, what happened to you? Mm-hmm. Now, my source of information comes through an electronic device. My communication with my friends comes through an electronic device.
Sure.
All right? Right before I walked in here, all right, my company has a bunch of group chats on various different platforms. And one person said, hey, I'm getting these spam emails that are coming from you and one of the other partners. And he takes screenshots and sends it to me. Okay? Now, if he wasn't savvy enough, and they're innocuous, it's like, hey, so-and-so, you know, do me a favor, send me your cell phone when you get a minute.
Right.
That's it. Not like, oh, I'm stuck in an airport in Nairobi and I lost all my money.
And I need $50,000. Right. Wire it to me?
It's that subtle.
Yeah, TransUnion or something.
Exactly. Yeah. It's that subtle. But, you know, having the background that he has, he picked up on it, he sends screenshots, and he's able to communicate that to us efficiently and effectively and in real time so that we can deal with it, right? If that's my primary source and means of communication is looking at my phone, I don't have the ability to sort of have the human aspect of things, right? That's gone.
Well, I think that human aspect, like, you know, doing what we do best, you know, in my past profession, what you've done, you know, the training that we both had, having that human connection and interaction where I can read your body language. I can see how you're feeling. Are you truly, you know, empathetic? Are you angry? You know, what's your emotions? You know, those things are lost because of that, right?
Yes.
And, you know, I've said it time and time again, as great as, you know, cell phones are, and, you know, they're essentially a massive, you know, mini computer, it's taken away that aspect of human interaction. And I think that answers probably my question, is where is that empathy?
You can't have empathy for something that is not human.
You can't feel it, you can't see it, you can't touch it. And it's really a shame. You go in any school in America and you see that, right?